the murder a few days back of 8 people in a particular part of Atlanta, and just fill us in on what happened and why it's important, why have you chosen this story?
Absolutely. So our headline talks about the Atlanta spa shooting, and Robert Arrett Long, who this headline is now talking about, has been kicked out of a Georgia church. So what's interesting is there have been a number of things really which people are saying are humanizing this man. This headline talks about the fact he was a church goer. One of the police chiefs actually said that Robert Aaron Long had a bad day. There's other news pieces talking about him being a kind of nerdy, quiet, shy, geeky guy at school. But I think the point here for a lot of people is that, you know, for a long time over the last few weeks, we've seen the narrative that black people have been attacking Asian people in the Asian community. And here is an example of Robert Aaron Long, a conservative guy from a rural part of Georgia, massacring 8 people for which he's been charged. 6 of them are Asian Americans, and many people are saying this is the definition of a hate crime. Other people are saying this is an example of a domestic act of terrorism, and they are saying that the media is reluctant to really diagnose it thusly, and so there's a kind of difference, if you like, between what people are saying is the actual reality and the narrative again being pushed by sort of sections of the media. And people are saying, look, let's just call it what it is.
And indeed, if it was anyone else, and what social media calling it, Richard today?
Okay, let's go first to Philip Walker, who says, you can look no further than the sudden false narrative that black people are targeting Asians. Meanwhile, white supremacist operatives like Robert Arrett Long are massacring Asians en masse. Bishop Talbot Swan says, while America tries to paint a black face on anti-Asian violence, a white supremacist, Robert Arrett Long, murders 8 Asians in Atlanta, and authorities won't call him a terrorist. They're mentioning sex addiction and saying they don't know the motive. And US Political Theater says, did the police also take domestic terrorist Robert Arrett Long to Burger King for lunch, like they did with domestic terrorist neo-Nazi Dylan Roof after he murdered 9 black people in a church?
Well, leave it there, Richard Sudan. Thank you. Now, Palestine has begun administering the first doses of the COVID-19 vaccine it's received from the global COVAX initiative to healthcare workers and older residents in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The United Nations-backed COVAX program delivered some 61,400 vaccines to the Palestinian Authority, with 21,300 jabs also being shipped to the besieged Gaza Strip. The news comes months after the Palestinian Authority blasted the Israeli regime for its decision to block vital vaccines from being delivered to the impoverished West Bank and Gaza Strip. Amnesty International and the World Health Organization have also joined in their calls to Israel, asking Tel Aviv to stop ignoring its international obligations as an occupying power and ensure the fair distribution of vaccines to Palestinians. 5 of Europe's southern states have stepped up calls for help and solidarity to other EU countries in managing the mass influx of refugees from entering the bloc. Interior ministers from Italy, Spain, Malta, Cyprus and Greece met over the weekend to discuss the issue and hash out a new migration pact, which would share the burden of mass migration with other members of the bloc. Thousands of refugees fleeing from Western-backed wars in places like Libya and Syria have died in the perilous maritime journey to reach EU shores. Critics of the EU have previously accused the 27-nation bloc of evading its responsibilities towards people making the journeys. More than half of all the UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunise the entire adult population by the end of the summer. Efforts are now underway to open large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
Earlier today, ministers from the European Union met in Brussels to discuss the bloc's relations with Turkey and Russia. High on the agenda will be the ongoing dispute over hydrocarbon resources in the eastern Mediterranean Sea between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece. Other points of discussion will include the Turkish detention of Kurdish politicians, as well as the imprisonment of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The meeting comes weeks after the 27-nation bloc announced it would be slapping retaliatory sanctions on Moscow over the Navalny case. Following their statement, Russia accused the bloc of interfering in the country's internal affairs. Robert in Lakesh, welcome back to the Bulletin. We're going to kick things off with, dare I say, some more misinformation being directed about Iran from Washington. Take it away.
Well, this time we see the report coming from The Hill. A number of different United States outlets, of course, take the words of U.S. Intelligence officers, as they call them, verbatim, no matter what they're saying. We're seeing this again in the case of this report, where they're saying that Iran had discussed a plan to attack a U.S. Army base in Washington, D.C. They cite two unnamed officials, and it's key that they are unnamed. There was no comment when they tried to reach out to the Pentagon and to intelligence agencies to verify these claims. But many people are pointing out that this comes at a crucial time when the Biden administration is attempting to get itself away from the responsibility which it pledged itself to, that is getting back into the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal. And on top of that as well, it looks like the Biden administration is poised to launch more strikes against the PMU, perhaps in Syria or in Iraq, again, as it did last month after an attack which targeted U.S. forces not linked to Iran. But of course, the U.S. media helped manufacture that dissent when it came to the retaliation, as it was called, which came to a group which was completely irrelevant to the strikes in the country.
So the easiest way now to justify your foreign policy is to just say Iran, whatever.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that reports like this are surfacing all the time when the Biden administration has pressure applied to it to try and get something achieved. And in this case, a promise which the Biden administration pledged, and that was to attempt to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, which they have not done. This is a foreign policy layup, as it has been called and described by many analysts. And we're seeing that Joe Biden has completely ignored this.
All right. What's been the online reaction to this story, Robert?
The first we've got here is from Hamid Morandi, who says, "The obedient American media mimics whatever garbage intelligence agencies tell them. They did that before the aggression against Iraq. They did that before bombing and destroying Libya. They did that regularly in Syria to justify aiding Al-Qaeda and illegal military strikes. Never ending," he says. And we've got another one here from journalist Max Blumenthal, who says, "The national security state is fabricating threats to overpower local opposition to further militarization of DC. First, the bogus threat of QAnon attacks, then this month to justify extending the National Guard occupation of Capitol Hill, and now this."
Okay, we move on to, well, some would say an inevitability in Israeli politics. New elections in just, what, 2 days?
Yes, we will see the elections on this Tuesday coming. And a lot of people, of course, in disarray as things can only get worse from here for Palestinians. It seems that Netanyahu has successfully divided up his opposition, former opposition member Benny Gantz of the Blue and White Party. Essentially has been destroyed in the polls. We're seeing that he will not even, or his party will barely make it into the Israeli Knesset this time around. And last time, Netanyahu had 4 opposition parties against him. Now he has 10. So his bid to divide has been successful. And on top of that, he's aligning himself with right-wing racist groups, the likes of which are Otzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power, as it's known in English, which essentially has been compared to the KKK because of its hardline racist views. Its leader, in fact, was convicted in 2007 of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting racism. And so when we talk about the Palestinians in this instance, we're seeing that if Netanyahu gets in, he's aligned with these far-right racist parties. And then if his opposition win as well, the number one figure against him is a man named Gideon Saar. Also, things are not looking good for the Palestinians because Gideon Saar is even more hardline than Netanyahu when it comes to the Palestinian issue and calls for the expulsion of Palestinians.
Tweets?
The first we've got here is from an Israeli actually commenting on this. They say, 55,000 people last night, all yelling, "Go, leave us alone to start rebuilding our lives and our country," a demonstration of power protest and a call for change to remove corrupted Netanyahu and his messengers from power. Elections in 2 days. So an unhappy Israeli there. Then we have another one here as well commenting on the issue of Netanyahu's being aligned to these racist parties. Says Netanyahu allies with extremist party denounced by many American groups, APACs actually included in that, who are openly calling for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
And this is a man who's facing charges. I don't understand why he's even allowed to run, briefly, Robert.
Well, this victory will mean that he can attempt to get past a bill which would essentially mean that the charges being brought against him would be dropped. So for him, this is a crucial victory to win, and that's why we're seeing him align so he can get those 61 seats in the Knesset and win.
Well, anything to save your skin, some might say. Robert Inlakesh, thank you, and thank you for being with us for this broadcast. Until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned. Truly, Allah loves those who have trusted. Here, trustful means the person whose only reference is Allah and believes in Him as the very first and last. In return, Allah loves such people too. In a verse of the Holy Quran, Allah addresses the believers and asks them, what kind of a believer you are when you don't have your trust in Allah in all of your affairs? You know that Allah is all aware and is informed about all of us. You also know that He is the all-powerful, the all-just.
خدای این چنانی را که من معتقد بهش هستم چرا در مشکلاتم در خانه دیگری را بزنم؟
So why should I knock on someone else's door when I know that Allah has such high qualities? If you ask Allah, He will surely answer you. Since Allah is the all-powerful, He is capable of solving everyone's problems. The only condition is to have trust in Him and be truthful to say that, O Allah, You are my only hope, and I come to Your door solely. Upon hearing this, Allah will help His believers. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salaam Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Amma ba'd faqad qala Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala fi kitabihi al-kareem wa yu'thiruna ala anfusihim wa law kana bihim khasasa. When we talk about the spirit of sacrifice, these acts of sacrifice indicate that while the martyrs lost their lives, they were able to pass on the spirit of humanity. And this is one dimension of the statement of the beloved sister of Abbas, Zainab. When she was asked by Ibn Ziyad in Kufa about her view of what happened on the day of Ashura in Karbala, when she says, "Ma ra'aytu illa jamilan," I did not see anything but beauty. She was actually, one of the application of that statement is that I saw the companions of my brother, I saw the family members of my brothers sacrificing their lives, not as an obligation, but willingly and on the basis of voluntarism. And this itself is beauty and jamal. And this is the greatest of achievement that the companions and the family members of my brothers attained on that day. Centuries after Karbala, we see that spirit of sacrifice continues. The example of volunteerism can also be seen in the present situation that the world is facing regarding COVID-19. Governments and charity organizations are doing whatever they can to relieve the pain and the suffering of the people. And there are many professionals who are doing their duty as the first line responders in this crisis. And there are many volunteers who are also helping the medical professionals to help those who are infected with the coronavirus. And there are also many who are volunteering to help those who have been affected by the lockdown of non-essential businesses. Those who are helping the seniors and the poor people who don't have the means to get the basic needs for the day-to-day lives. Some of the mu'mineen asked a question to the Grand Ayatollah Sistani about the work and the sacrifice of the medical professionals and the volunteers who are the frontline, you know, fighters in this fight against coronavirus. And the way they worded the question, it says, "It is no secret that regular people, medical staff, including nurses, doctors, and volunteers in hospitals and medical centers are placing themselves in harm's way as they help those who are or may be inflicted with the coronavirus." What words does the Grand Marja have for them? In response, the office of Ayatollah Sistani issued a statement on his behalf. And it's worth, you know, reading that and spreading that to the world. He says, "The responsibility of treating Caring for and helping the ill is wajibi kifai. It's a collective obligation. And if those who are fulfilling it, they do not do it, if everybody abandons it, then the whole society is collectively responsible. So it is wajibi kifai upon those who are qualified to do so, including physicians, nursing staff, and others. However, it is the responsibility of the authorities concerned to provide them all that is needed to protect themselves from the danger of contracting the virus. There is no excuse for their failure or delay in doing so to help those who are in the medical field and the nurses who are helping here. There is no doubt, he continues to write, there is no doubt that the work that is being done by these dear individuals, despite of all the challenges they face, is a great work, and their efforts are priceless and maybe as close in importance as fighting side by side in the trenches with the heroes defending one's homeland and its people. It is certain that Almighty Allah appreciates their efforts in this world and will reward them in the hereafter. In fact, we ask Allah for those who have sacrificed their lives in this path, both the reward and the status of a martyr on the Day of Judgment. He concludes by saying, we thank them greatly and express our highest appreciation for their humanitarian work and ask Allah the Lofty, the All-Capable, to protect them and keep them from all harm. Surely He is all-hearing and most able to answer our du'as. This was written on 21st of Rajab, which is equivalent to 22nd March 2020. In another set of questions sent to him by some other mu'mineen, one of the questions were very interesting, and I would like to share that so that we can understand that when we talk about those who are volunteering in this field at the moment, in this extraordinary circumstances, you know, Islam values their sacrifice and their hard work. One of the questions that they heard from Ayatollah Sistani was, what advice do you have for the believers in light of these difficult conditions that they are facing from this dangerous pandemic? The response to this question was, take care of those infected, no matter their affiliations in religion or sect, with the goal of easing their burden and supporting them in their needs. And so we see when we talk about this issue of helping people during this crisis, you know, there is no boundary of religion and sect here. This is a humanitarian issue, this is a human crisis, and we should help in whatever way we can. So I would like to take this opportunity, in the spirit of sacrifice of Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam, to salute those volunteers who put themselves into danger of contracting the virus for the sake of others. They indeed are following the example of the Shuhada of Karbala and are keeping alive the spirit of sacrifice exemplified in the person of Abbas bin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. Keeping the spirit of sacrifice alive has been very beautifully put in a line of poetry by an Indian poet, Payam Azmi Sahib, where he says, Jin haaton se bhai ko sahara na mile, un haaton se Abbas ka matam na karo. Jin haaton se bhai ko sahara na mile, those hands which are not helping the brothers, in haaton se Abbas ka matam na karo, do not use those hands to do the matam of Abbas. If you really want to be in line with Abbas and his purpose of life and the sacrifice that he has made, then you have to follow his example of sacrifice. You know, we have to look at this situation not only about those who are suffering from this illness, the coronavirus. Look around. If you are able to help those who are in need at this time, because of the lockdown, many would not have the ability even to get their
you know, daily food and basic needs of the time. If you have the ability, this will be the moment of seeking that opportunity to achieve the place, the pleasure, and the rida of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Adi Ali Hali Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up? In a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day, when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today we're going to be dealing with some of the menstruation-related laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but In 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, you know, in the Indian subcontinent, sometimes some countries will ask questions like this, that there are different ghusl or ritual bathing that, you know, people have to take, and, you know, because it is required and obligatory in their religion to do so. Are there any differences between the types or the way to take the ghusl, to take this shower, this ritual shower, to cleanse oneself, to gain purity, ritual purity, whether it is the ghusl for example, janaba or nifas or whatever?
Okay. You rightly mentioned something which I think which is very much applicable to the Indian Shia Muslims. As they inquire and they put this question and direct their questions to, let's say, to religious authorities, asking if there is any difference between the different types of ghusl. We know that there are actually different types of ghusl, but when it comes to the method, the way we perform ghusl, I think there's no difference in how we and the way we should perform ghusl. According to all religious authorities, every individual who's supposed to perform ghusl should wash his head and neck. A woman should wash his head and neck first. And then, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, he should wash the right side of the body and then the left side of the body. But Ayatollah Sistani says it's not necessary to observe this sequence, okay? Mm-hmm. So after washing the head and neck, it is all right to wash your body, beginning from either the left or the right. But he does say, Ayatollah Sistani does say, that it's better to start washing the body from the right side and finish it with the left side. This is not obligatory according to Ayatollah Sistani, but Ayatollah Khamenei says no, he should start with the right side and finish with the left side. That's the popular opinion, the opinion of most religious authorities. It is an opinion widely held by the religious authorities and fuqaha, of course.
Mm-hmm. You also said in the previous episodes that usually there is a time difference of 3 to 10 days for the blood discharge to be considered as menstruation.
Yes.
All right?
Sure.
Imagine a woman who has a regular monthly period of 7 days.
Yes.
But this woman has the discharge for about 12 days as a result of using some medications such as contraceptives.
Sure.
All right, or contraceptive devices or pill. Well, is this charge after the 7th day, all right, onward, to be regarded or considered as menstruation, or is it istihada?
Well, some women have a fixed habit of menstruation.
Mm-hmm.
And those who have a fixed habit of menstruation and monthly discharge, they should act according to their habit. They should follow their habit, even if they discharge blood for more than, let's say, 7 days, as you gave the example of 7 days. Okay?
Yes.
And you rightly you mentioned that okay, there's a woman who has a fixed habit of 7 days,
mm-hmm.
but because of contraceptives, she has now begun to bleed for more than 7 days. Of course, the extra days should not and cannot be considered as hais. And of course, we did discuss it in the previous episode that if a woman does not have a fixed habit of monthly discharge and her bleeding is irregular, sometimes she discharges blood for 5 days, sometimes for 6 days, sometimes even for 8 or 9 days, okay? This woman does not have a fixed habit of menstruation, and therefore such a woman should and of course can should treat all the blood as her the blood of menses, okay, beginning from the 3rd day until the 10th day, because we know that the period or the monthly period is not less than 3 days,
mm-hmm.
and not more than 10 days.
Yes.
So if a woman who does not have a fixed habit of bleeding,
mm-hmm.
Discharges blood for 10 days, all the 10 days should be considered as the blood of menstruation.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
What about her habit? Her habit of having the 7 days of blood discharge.
I did, I think, explain that.
Yes.
And I said that if there's a woman who has a fixed habit of menstruation or blood discharge, like the example you gave,
yes.
7 days.
She should go according to the habit.
Yeah, according to the habit.
I see.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just and the to extra, be clear.
Yeah. The extra days should be considered as
istihadah.
Istihadah, of course.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, what is Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwa about the ladies willing to enter the shrines of the imams? What about their sons and children?
Oh, that's also a question of daily concern for some ladies and some women who want to
visit the graves and tombs
of
the saints, imams, and
the
their
imams, of course.
Children, yes.
As for the saints and the sons and grandsons of the imams are concerned, there's no need
doubt.
Ritual. There's no doubt, and there's no difference of opinion among the religious authorities. One, a woman can enter these places, these holy places, of course, without making wudu, without performing ghusl, and there's no need for ritual purity. As for the Holy Shrine is concerned, Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that there is no need for ritual purity either. So a woman who is in her menses can enter the Holy Shrine and can get close to the chamber, to the Zareh, and can stay there, can, of course, do anything she wants, okay? There's no need for tahara, ritual purity, although ritual purity is highly recommended when going to such places, of course. But a woman should make sure that she does not walk into a mosque,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because there are mosques. Maybe, for example, let's consider the holy shrine of Imam Reza, alayhi salatu wasalam. If a woman is going in, there are many mosques inside the holy shrine, okay? There are mosques. One, for example, there's a room called... For example, even here in the holy city of Qom, for example, there are two mosques very close to the chamber of Lady Masuma.
Yes.
So a woman should make sure that she does not walk into that mosque or stays there or maybe sleep there, okay? Because it's haram to stay in a mm-hmm. mosque. It's haram for a woman, an menstruating woman, to enter. Ayatollah Khamenei, let me put it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Khamenei says that it is not necessary, generally speaking,
yes.
for a woman to perform ghusl for entering the shrine. She can enter the mosque even if she is menstruating.
Mm-hmm. So there is no doubt about it.
There is no doubt.
All right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Salaamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. How are you?
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
So, dear audience, in the previous program, we were discussing about a question that where mother is asking, I enrolled my two boys to gymnastics a few months ago, and they were doing really well. But all of a sudden, they lost all motivation for it. I don't think anything specific happened, but they just don't want to go anymore. My children are 7 and 5. What do you advise me to do? So in the previous show, we were discussing about how to keep our children motivated and how children should have a sense of achievement when they're doing specific activities. And Brother Miqdad, in this program, we'll discuss about the things which will have a negative impact on children. So please continue.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we talked about the positive things, the things that bring about motivation, whether it's fun, whether mm-hmm. it leads to a sense of achievement and yeah. success, sense of fitting, also working together with other friends, finding friends and partners mm-hmm. in what they do. And then we talked about the importance of not having any negative impacts,
mm-hmm.
those things that will actually remove motivation. So one of them obviously is too much criticism, mm-hmm. right? When we have too much criticism, especially in children that are 5 and 7,
mm-hmm.
What happens is that they feel not appreciated, and they feel mm-hmm. has a direct link with demotivation, mm-hmm. basically. That they do something, and when they do this thing, the teacher or the parent, the mm-hmm. coach or the brothers and sisters, tell them that this move is not right, this is not right over here, and this is particular one is not correct, that one is not correct. This actually builds a kind of sense of frustration within them and a sense of lack of achievement that I thought I did it well, but suddenly my teacher said there's 3 faults in it, my parents said there's 5 faults in it.
It demotivates them.
It demotivates them. The lack of achievement comes over there. So we have to be very careful about criticism. Now, obviously, as parents and especially as trainers and coaches, we want the best from these young children that are doing gymnastics, and you want to teach them and make them better and improve their skills. So there is a level of teaching which involves correcting, right? But there's a way to do it, right? Which ensures that the child feels this level of achievement, but at the same time is happy to actually take on board criticism, right? So one of the things that we do, for example, is to actually train a child that accept or ask for criticism, right? So you show them the way it's done, a particular move, how it's done, whether you the trainer
does it
himself.
Rather than criticizing, you teach them.
Exactly. So you show it, for example. And then you tell them, like, let's look at it and say, how can we do this better, right? And naturally, you'll see the child will do it. And it's like, can you please watch me and see how I can improve it? Where did I go wrong? When a child asks for criticism, this is very positive. This is where you can actually start teaching this. Okay, if you do this better, this might work. Another way is to asking questions, for example, saying, is it possible for you to do this? Or do you think if you do this in this way, it might improve the move or the particular skill? So through different ways, we can actually teach a child to improve their skill. Sometimes it just simply requires time. The more a child practices, and the slowly the child will just get the hang of it, basically, and how it's done. We don't always have to go in very straight and criticize and correct it too quickly. And this applies to different spheres of our lives as well. This applies to not just in sports, but in other things as well, in tarbiyah, whether it's related to our religious practices, etc., our behavior. Parents have to learn that in tarbiyah, we don't always have to go and attack. We don't have to go and criticize. Sometimes, through time and practice, things just correct themselves.
Thank you so much, Brother Maghdad, and your audience, it's time for a short break. We'll be right back after a short break.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. We're discussing about how criticism creates a negative impact on children. So it might be the coach or it might be the parents. Brother Maghdad mentioned that the better way of criticism is, you know, rather than criticizing the children, you need to teach them. So Brother Maghdad, please continue.
Another thing that negatively impacts motivation is humiliation, is any words or even actions that could affect one's self-respect or one's self-confidence. If a child feels that I was laughed at or I was told in a way that my respect wasn't maintained, whether it's by teachers or even by parents, this actually is a natural cause for demotivation. We should always be in a way to encourage self-respect and self-confidence, right? Children who feel that they have a sense of importance, that they feel that they are able to do things, are children that are their motivation to do them, right? The moment you lose that feeling, the moment you think that, no, I'm not able to do it, if you don't think you're able to do it, you won't do it, right? You won't feel motivated to do things. So what are the key factors for motivation? And this is applicable anywhere. What motivates one of the things that motivates a person to do certain thing is actually to understand and to realize that they are able to do it. In fact, let me mention in bracket over here, one of the reasons why many of us don't feel motivated to embark on the spiritual journey or get closer to Allah, try and correct our sins and perform good actions. One of the reasons is because we think that we are not able to do so. We think that we won't be able to get to the to the goal, right? We think that we're not good enough for the spirituality. This is what we think of ourselves, and this is why we don't have any motivation to do so. So So the mistake comes at that realization that, no, actually, no, you are able to. Yeah. Allah has created you in a way that you are able to do this. Mm-hmm. And that it is within you, and you have the ability to go on this journey and remove yourself from doing, from committing sins and adopt the path of the servitude of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Similarly, in gymnastics, for children, the same thing as well. You want to give them as much confidence as they can, as much self-respect. They are able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then maintaining that. And once they have this feeling that mm-hmm. they are able to, then they'll be motivated to do so. If I'm able to, then why not? Yeah. Let me just do it.
So this thing applies everywhere, that wherever there's a lack of hope, there's demotivation.
Very good. Exactly. Giving hope is fundamental over here. So you create goals for children. You create role models for children. Mm-hmm. You create for them a target that they can achieve, that they're able to achieve. And you give them the ability and the sense of self-respect that I can do it. Mm-hmm. And once they have that, then they feel motivation to go all the way and do it.
Thanks so much, Brother Magdad. And the audience, it's time for a short break. We'll be right back. Do not go anywhere.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience. You're listening to Islamic upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And we're discussing about the negative impacts of criticism. So, Brother Magdad, please continue.
So, on a practical level, when it comes to this parent, for example, one thing is to listen to the child. Ask the child about their session, the gymnastics session. Yeah. Don't argue or try and reason with the child. Rather, just have positive communication. And if you feel that there is a lack of confidence, then obviously it's time to increase a bit of descriptive praise, which means that you really highlight and praise and appreciate those things that they do through describing it to them.
Yeah.
That this action that you did had this consequence, which was really nice.
Yeah.
This was a very beautiful way of doing a particular thing. So give a lot of positive energy to children, both for the gymnastics session as well as generally.
Mm-hmm.
Children who have general positive energy are more motivated to do things.
Yeah.
So communication with the children, motivating the children, talking to the children, listening to the children, find out exactly if anything has happened. Sometimes someone from the group might have laughed at them, might have said something to them, they might have not enjoyed something. Find out the cause. If something has happened in the classroom, then you can work on it.
So these are the negative factors which leads to demotivation.
Exactly. Spending time with children as well, especially one-to-one, sometimes it really helps. Children feels motivated to do things when they have one-on-one time with the parent. They can show what they've learned. They can express how they feel about the class. They can discuss it in a more open way. Lastly, one of the things that could lead to demotivation is also when we involve our children in too many different activities at the same time. So the child is doing gymnastics on Mondays, but football on Tuesdays, and basketball on Wednesdays, and volleyball on Thursdays, and swimming on Fridays.
So they're not able to focus on one particular thing.
Exactly. And then they're comparing different incentive, different ways. They're not stable. This leads to motivation for pretty much everything, demotivation for pretty much everything then. So focus on one or two things at a time. So if you're doing gymnastics right now, do one more thing and then focus on that basically. Up until it becomes stable, they've got a routine in it. It's a normal thing. Then maybe you can add another thing. Obviously, we want children to be very active, definitely, at